So again, the problem is that, see, this is all fine and dandy until there's some problem that comes along, and these companies have used all their capital to buy back shares to support their share price and bail out their executives, and then all of a sudden they can't support the company during an economic downturn. And that's why they should be made illegal, right? Because that capital should be used for purposes of shoring up their balance sheet, creating better opportunities for, their workers, expanding their business, doing capital expenditures or research and development, all of which employs more people. And that's what creates a better economic environment, not buying back shares.
Welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm Thoughtful Money founder and your host, Adam Taggart, here with you at the end of yet another week with my good friend, industrious portfolio manager, Lance Roberts. Lance, how you doing?
I'm hanging in there. I lost my voice on Wednesday, and I'm just now starting to get it back. So you'll have to just bear with me being a little bit croaky today. So, and hopefully I can get through a little bit of this before I lose it again. So let's just see what we get done today.
All right. And folks, we're going to keep this one a little shorter than normal, one, both to save Lance's voice. Two, I am on vacation, as you can tell by the background. And I've got a family that is waiting for me to finish this recording so that we can head out and enjoy our day. Lance, I picked industrious because I'm on vacation while you sadly are back in the salt mines. It's been another week, another all-time high in the markets. So we certainly got some questions for you about the market action, because you have been saying, over the past number of weeks now that risk of a pullback is getting higher and higher the longer the elastic band keeps getting stretched like this. Now, obviously, if we hang out for long enough at this point, it gives the moving averages time to catch up. What's winning out right now, the price appreciation or the catch up of the moving averages?
The price appreciation. We haven't, we kind of look like that we were starting to maybe do a little bit of topping over the last week, previous to Wednesday. And the market had kind of been starting that angle of ascent had started to slow down just a bit and looked like maybe we were going to start to consolidate. But then on Wednesday, the much more dovish FOMC meeting came out and the markets rocketed to all-time highs, which negated any of that process. So, you could not really create a much better, I'm working on sharing a screen here. So just bear with me one second. If you take a look at this trend channel, only Bernie Madoff could come up with a chart like this, for managing money. It's the market dips to the 20-day moving average. The computer algorithms step in, they buy those dips to the 20-day, you rally to the top of the trend channel like we did yesterday, and the market fails. And we're a little bit lower today so far on Friday. So again, just a very defined, narrow channel that continues. And this channel is very long in the tooth. This is longer than the one we had back in June and July of last year that eventually resolved into a 10% correction. The kind of 45 degree angle of the market continues to exist here. It's very bullish. There's nothing, nothing not bullish about that. Complacency is extremely low. Volatility, as represented by the VIX index, remains, extremely muted.
Okay. Sorry. Complacency is extremely high, by the
way. Yes. I'm sorry. Volatility is low. Complacency is very high. And if you take a look at, professional investors' allocations, retail investors' allocations, they're all creeping up. Household equity allocations are near all-time highs. So again, you just could not ask for a more bullish market right now. And again, yes, we still expect a correction to come. And yes, we will have a correction. But the problem with that and saying that is that it can take a lot longer than you think. And so, as is always the risk to investing, what we do as investors is if I come out and say, okay, we're going to have a correction, then people go out and they sell everything because I said there's going to be a correction. Well, then Lance is wrong because he said there was going to be a correction. The timing is always the hard part. And these markets, and particularly very complacent, low volatility markets, can remain this way for a lot longer than you think. And this condition has lasted much longer than we've seen in previous periods. So again, it will resolve itself eventually, but that's why we just now have to wait. And as we've kind of talked about over the last couple of weeks, your warning sign is going to be that break of that 20-day moving average. Once those computer algorithms, once we break that 20-day moving average, very likely the algos that have been buying that moving average will start selling it, because that will now be the break that they're programmed to. So a break of that 20-day, you'll see a big pickup in selling, a sharper decline, and then you'll probably start a correction process at that point.
Okay, so a couple of things. First off, in your chart here, the 20-day moving average is the red line there in the middle, yes, correct?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, correct. All right. And just because you brought up the algos, a ton of market activity now happens from these algorithms, right? Which are basically software programs that people write. There's sort of an arms race in the big money, right? Of who's got the best algos that are the smartest and can trade the market the most, right?
That's right.
If you read the book Flash Boys by Michael Lewis, you've got a good sense of kind of the craziness that goes on in that world in terms of who can hire the best quants and who can write the best models and who can get the fastest direct connection to the exchanges. I mean, there's a massive universe there that we as regular investors just don't see, right? And I can't remember what the percentage of trades that are made by the algos is these days versus a live human, but it's the vast majority. And I know that it's almost all quotes, like 99.99999% of quotes are generated by algos. So there's a saying, I just want to get your reaction to it, which is like, a neutron bomb could take out all life on the planet. And like trading would continue.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, in that case, and again, we've seen this as, just a good example of this. Bitcoin's had a huge run here lately. It's been correcting, recently since I wrote that article about Bitcoin topping. But, it's been correcting. But that whole advance in Bitcoin happened after market hours. So, that's the other problem, is that there's a lot of trading that goes on after market hours that retail investors don't get to play in, but institutions do. So it's not a fair and equal playing field for the average investor.
Yeah. And I don't have the chart handy, but you were reminding me of charts that we saw often kind of in that stretch between 2010 and 2021, which would show that I want to say not the majority, but maybe almost all the increase in the S&P was happening after hours.
Yeah,
so it's right. Sort of like if you traded US, daily hours, which is what every retail investor does, I think you actually lost money over like one of the best bull runs of all time, right? But if you had the ability to trade in the overnight markets, you made a killing over that same time.
Yeah, that's right. No, and that still goes on today. A lot of the gains that are made overnight when the futures trade. It's a much thinner market, but it's also a market that, institutions can play in fairly easy. So, they can move that price around a bit more than they can during the day. But again, you go back and look at how much money was made after hours versus what was made during market hours. And again, to your point, there's lots of charts out there that show that the vast majority of gains, if not all of them, were actually accrued after market hours.
Oh, that's good. And of course, we're talking about trading. So, if you were a retail investor and just bought and then held during that period, you did okay. But to Lance's point, there's many, many advantages that tilt the playing field vastly towards, the institutional, buyers and whatnot, and us little guys generally always get the short end of the stick, which is one of the reasons why I always refer people to good financial advisors, because you're at least trying to recruit a professional to get on your side there. All right, so no big surprise, we're at another all-time high in the markets this week. There have been some folks out there that have called for S&P 6000, right, over the past couple of years. And now all of a sudden, I'm hearing from a lot of their people saying, hey, these guys are right. And who knows, they might be. We always talk about the gravitational pull of the big round number. We were talking about this as we were getting close to 5,000 on the S&P. Well, we blew through that. What do you think? Is there enough oomph in this market to get us to 6,000 S&P this year?
Yeah, well, I don't know about this year, but certainly
we'll
next year.
We'll get there eventually, but I'm just curious.
Yeah. I don't know if we go straight there from here. I mean, it's certainly, look, anything is possible, right? I mean, you're talking roughly about 800 points on the S&P. So, you know, it's not a tremendous stretch to get there. And, you know, if there's some type of, you know, the Fed, you know, stops QT entirely, starts going back to QE, and they're already talking about that. If we get some type
Pell's beginning to show a little leg on that. Yeah. So,
So, you know, and so again, you know, there's some, certainly some things that could get this market there. I'll tell you the one thing that's, I'm going to share a screen with you. This is one thing that kind of jumped out to me this morning. I was doing kind of my morning run on Twitter, and I was posting some charts, and this one really kind of jumped out to me a bit. I actually got a couple, but this one really kind of, so this is the rolling 21 week U.S. equity fund flows, and funds and ETFs. And what's interesting is that you have this massive increase in the amount of funds flowing into equity funds. Now, 2020, 2021 made complete sense, right? Because we were sending checks to households. And even though we hear all these stories about how tapped the consumer is and how the balance sheets are weak and blah, 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 they're coming up with a lot of cash to invest in equities and chase this market. So, you know, the whole equity chase is certainly back in terms of the markets. And again, you know, when markets are going up, investors are really able to find, you know, excess cash to invest either through leverage or however they're doing it. We are seeing free credit balances on margins go back up. So, you know, people are leveraging into the market. But again, it's just quite fascinating that even, you know, higher interest rates, you know, 5.25%, 5.5% by the Fed, and higher interest rates on long bonds and higher borrowing costs. And of course, you know, all, you know, we talk about all these other impacts on the consumer. They are certainly piling into equities, you know, kind of hand over fist right now in terms of the retail side. Now, again, you have to understand retails are very, very small buyers of the markets, right? Corporations are your big buyers. We wrote an article talking about corporate share buybacks earlier this week and went through all the math. But here's a kind of a quick, you know, down low on that. If you take out pension funds and mutual funds, so this is equity flows since the beginning of the turn of the century, since 2000. So pensions have sold $2.2 trillion in equities. Makes sense. They've got to fund retirees, right? So they have a retiree, you know, surge that's going on right now. We wrote an article on Social Security and pension plans on actually today on Friday.
We're going to talk about that in a bit. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a big problem. But again, pensions have to sell equities in order to fund the retirement benefits. Mutual funds have lost about $500 billion worth of flows because that's moved over to ETFs. So households are up about 6.6 trillion. Foreign investors have bought about 1.8 trillion. Corporations, 5.5. So you do math on this, take out the negatives from the positives. Corporations have bought 100% of the equity market since 2000. So again, that's all of your equity flows. Yeah. Sorry.
Is that buybacks?
Yeah. That's corporate buybacks.
Okay.
So in other words, the only net buyer, once you subtract out the gainers and the losers, the only net buyer of equities has been corporations since the turn of the century. And most of that, and again, like I said, we wrote about buybacks on Tuesday. That's all been a massive surge really since 2016, 2017, which is why small caps and mid caps have really underperformed large caps during that same time frame. Because
they don't have the war chest.
Exactly.
Yeah. Super interesting. So you talk about how you have markets like Japan, right, where the government basically is the bond market now, right?
Right. Well, was. They still really.
Pardon me?
So Japan just announced that they're going to stop buying equities and bonds. So we'll see what happens.
Okay. Actually, we should talk about that in the future show to see what the impact of that's going to be. But, you know, for years now, basically nobody in Japan was buying bonds. And so the government stepped in and bought them all, right? It sounds like we sort of have the corporate version of that going on in the equity markets. Not that nobody is buying equities right now, but on a net basis, you're saying,
yeah.
Basically, what's driving this market is the companies themselves that are listed on these exchanges. And this is almost, I mean, it kind of has a little bit of a feel of, you know, the promoter who's buying his own shares just to keep driving the price. And hey, if you can get away with it, you know, why not just keep buying to infinity, right? And of course, one of the things you and I have railed in the past about this is that, you know, buybacks, there's a lot of accounting gimmickry that goes on there. And hey, look, it's real money that's being used to buy the shares in most cases. But it's an extraction vehicle for the top executives and the biggest investors in these companies.
True. That's one of the big myths that is portrayed by Wall Street on investors, which says it's a return of cash to shareholders. In fact, there was a survey out this morning from Bank of America that said that there's a rising number of investors that are wanting more share capital, return of capital functions by corporations, right? Which is basically code for buyback. When somebody buys back shares of a company, Apple doesn't send you a check, right? There is no return of cash to you when they buy back their own shares. Now, if they issue a dividend, right, you get a dividend. So that's actually return of cash.
Right.
And the SEC's done numerous studies on this. And of course, this has, you know, been one of the big conundrums since the turn of the century, which has been this massive surge in buy. The only one that from that are, to your point, insiders, which are selling their shares back to the company to fund stock option compensation programs, their compensation, et cetera. Right. So
they get a check.
They get a check. You don't. And again, you know, it's kind of a ridiculous statement when a company buys back shares, it's a return of capital to shareholders. Well, it is only from the function that supposedly the price goes up. Well,
the shares go up, yeah.
Right. So my share prices went up because the company bought back their own shares. So they must think the company's cheap. And look, I just wrote about this this past week. Let me find, I want to show you something real fast.
I was going to ask about this exact thing you're pulling up here. So.
Because there's, because also have a different quote from Warren Buffett as well, which is kind of important to this whole thing. So first of all, if you go back and look at share buybacks really became of age, and you know, post the financial crisis, and since 2011, the increase in the S&P, 27% of that increase has come solely from buybacks. Then of course there's earnings that provided some of the growth. Dividends and et cetera. Now, before the correction, so going into 2020, 44% of the return of the index had come from buybacks. So again, that correction during 22, when we had that kind of sell-off in the markets, has reduced that gain a little bit. But now it's starting to catch back up again.
Sorry to interrupt, but just for the viewers here, the buybacks are the green in this chart, right?
Yeah. So in other words, the S&P would be 27% lower than where it is now if it wasn't for buybacks. So again, this is the big problem. And so what this chart shows is this is the cumulative change in share buybacks versus the cumulative change in the S&P since 1994. And so you can see that between 1994 and 2000, basically there was no buybacks going on. Now, why is that? So buybacks were illegal prior to 1990. They were considered to be a form of stock market manipulation prior to 1990. But why all of a sudden did buybacks become in vogue after 1999, really starting in 2000? Well, remember in 1999, Bill Clinton, who was president at the time, he was going after this wealth gap between corporate executives and the population. So he passed this law that said, well, corporate executives can only get paid a total of $1 million. And so Wall Street said, okay, that's fine. We'll do the rest of his comp in stock options. And so that's when stock options really took off and buybacks became a function of funding that compensation structure for corporate executives. And then post 2008, you can just see that all of a sudden the cumulative change in those buybacks has just been getting larger and larger and larger. And the reason is this is how companies are beating earnings estimates. Because if I buy back shares, it lowers the number of shares outstanding. So when I'm looking at a dollar's worth of earnings versus the number of shares outstanding, my EPS goes up as I reduce that number of shares. So in order to make earnings and, of course, continue to meet compensation structures, et cetera, I'm having to issue more and more of these stock buybacks. And now you'll notice, like FedEx just reported earnings today, revenues were down, shipments were down, stocks up like 11 or 12% today because they announced a $5 billion share buyback. This has become commonplace for companies, even though they have Apple's great example of this. We just, Michael Leibowitz just wrote an article about Apple and buybacks recently, is that companies that have slower rates of revenue and earnings growth are now focusing more and more on buybacks to help supplant the difference. And this is, you know, become a normality for the markets over time. And again, if we just take a look at earnings growth, so this is S&P 500 trailing earnings, and that's what's in red. So that's trailing EPS. Now, you'll notice that that peak in the S&P, you know, in 2022, we had the bear market, supposedly correction, and then the market's taken off. Well, you'll notice that earnings were kind of just flat during that period, but in reality, earnings declined. And then they've come back up a bit. But the reason that earnings are flat is because buybacks have been going up, and that's been supporting that earnings decline. In other words, we didn't get the big decline in earnings that we should have gotten during that correction and during that slowdown in the economy. Remember, we had two negative quarters of GDP growth in 2020, right? And we never showed that really reflected in earnings. And that was because the increase in buybacks have been supporting that weaker earnings growth. So that's why you never had that decline in earnings. And now—
And sorry, you're, when you say decline in earnings, you mean decline in earnings per share.
Earnings per share, right? So, because that's the way we look at EPS, right? So this is earnings per share for the S&P 500.
And the earnings were going down, but they were removing shares with the buybacks, and therefore the earnings per share didn't adjust the way that—
Exactly. They were flattish, right? And yeah. So all of a sudden, things look a whole lot better than they did in reality. But you can also see this just if you take a look at this chart. So this is the four-week change in share buybacks versus the S&P. And it's kind of like a volatility graph, but you can see that it's really starting in about 2015, 2016. There's just a big expansion of these buybacks. And of course, when you have periods of declining buybacks, the markets decline. And when you have periods of expanding buybacks, markets go up. And that's why there's an 85% correlation between the four-week cumulative change in buybacks versus the S&P change. So in other words, without buybacks, the market would not be doing what it's doing, because a big function, this goes back to that chart I started with, was showing that the corporate buybacks are making up about 100% of the net equity purchases of the market. That's why there's such a huge correlation between buybacks and the market.
Hey, can I ask a leading question on that chart, which is, so buybacks were illegal in the past because they were considered a form of stock manipulation, yeah, right? You pull up a chart like that, that says, yeah, basically there's an incredible correlation between these buybacks and the increase in the S&P. How does that just not remake the case, which is that, hey, this drives the price of the indices. This is manipulation. Is anyone asking why is this still legal?
Well, it's funny because Mike and I just had this conversation this morning, in that, you know, if we go back in history, you know, we've had problems in the markets before. And again, a lot of people watching your video right now or watching this video are a lot younger. They weren't around at the turn of the century when Enron blew up. And of course, you know, when Enron blew up, you know, we had to change things. So we came out with Sarbanes-Oxley, right? And so we had to fix the accounting system because of the things that were created. Now, while Enron was running their scam, nobody cared because they were just printing money hand over fist. So as long as everybody's making money, nobody really looks at this stuff and nobody really cares. They say, oh, well, stock buybacks, hey, it's a return of capital shareholders. What can be wrong with that, right? It's all good. You know, the reason that they're not good is because it's a misuse of capital by companies. And there is a consequence for that. And we were talking about this earlier today, which is eventually buybacks will be shut down at some point. And the reason will be is that something will happen where buybacks are found to be the culprit. And let me give you a good example of, we actually almost got there. In 2020, when we shut down the economy, we had to bail out Boeing, a massive corporation, right? They make billions of dollars a year in their profits, but they'd spent 5 years using all of their cash to buy back shares to support their stock. And so when we shut down the economy, all of a sudden they didn't have any capital on hand. And so we had to go bail them out. We had to bail out Royal Caribbean, who is also a massive share repurchaser as well. So again, you know, the problem is that, see, this is all fine and dandy until there's some problem that comes along. And these companies have used all their capital to buy back shares to support their share price and bail out their executives. And then all of a sudden they can't support the company during an economic downturn. And that's why they should be made illegal, right? Because that capital should be used for purposes of shoring up their balance sheet, creating better opportunities for, you know, their workers, expanding their business, doing capital expenditures, research and development, all of which employs more people. And that's what creates a better economic environment, not buying back shares. And the reason I bring all this up is that I quoted Warren Buffett in his latest shareholder report. He says the math isn't complicated. When the share count goes down, your interest in our many businesses increases. He's right, right? That's an absolutely true statement. So if you own Berkshire Hathaway and he buys back shares, then your interest is greater in all the businesses he owns because there's fewer shares outstanding. So your shares are worth more. So absolutely a true statement. Every small bit helps, even if repurchases are made at value, if repurchases are made at value accretive prices. There's the key sentence. He goes on to explain. Just as surely, when a company overpays for repurchases, the continuing shareholders lose. At such times, gains flow only to the selling shareholders. See, this is the point I'm trying to make about this is not a return of capital to investors. The gains flow only to selling shareholders. Well, who's selling? It's the insiders. It's not you, right? You're not selling your Berkshire Hathaway stock. The insiders are. And actually not in that case, but you know, if it's Apple or these other share buyback companies. The gains only flow to the selling shareholders and to the friendly but expensive investment banker who recommended the foolish purchases in the first place. And so this is the point that eludes most investors. They love buybacks because it's driving up the price. There's an end game to this. I don't know where it is, but there's an end game to where the dark side of all this will come out. Now, again, this could be decades from now. But in theory, right, if companies keep purchasing back all their shares at the current pace that they're doing, they'll eventually all be private, right? I mean, you've got to either issue more shares at some point to keep buying them back, or you're going to buy back all of your shares. Now, for a company like Apple, you know, there's billions of shares that'll take a long time, but you get the point. You know, there is a point to where there is a return on that investment that is not lucrative to companies.
Yeah, and, you know, to me, this has a similar feel to, you know, we do a bunch of stimulus, it creates inflation. And so to deal with the inflation pain that the average person is feeling, we send them checks in the mail, right? Which makes them feel better in the moment, but it makes the inflation problem even worse, right? So here we are giving gargantuan returns to the insiders and the friendly, which, by the way, the friendly also includes our congresspeople, right? Yep. Who have ridiculously successful trading records, many of them trading these companies because they're sitting there at the front row of writing legislation and knowing who's going to benefit from this stuff.
Right.
And to your point, you know, we as little investors, well, you know, if we look at it with just our own selfish point of view, oh, if I own Apple and Apple goes up, well, then I'm doing well. So yeah, buybacks are great, right? But to your point, like you eventually carry this out where like whatever value these companies have, eventually they go private, right? If you keep doing this and then you don't get to own any of it. And everybody, right. You know, the insiders who do, they own all the equity of this thing. And to your point as well, it's just like, you know, it's all continuing this whole sort of too big to fail game. Like the Boeing example is a great example of this, but we all remember this during the banking crisis as well, right? Like these guys are basically just siphoning value out of these companies. And if they get in trouble, they know the government's going to step in. And that was, I remember reading those headlines and being really angry about what was going on with Boeing, which is, wait a minute, these guys have just been lining their pockets, right? Yeah. And then now because the company's drained to cash, we have to pony up to bail them out, right? And it's not like they stopped paying management bonuses or stuff like that, right? So, you know, why would they change? It's the best deal in the world for these guys.
Right. Well, no, and that's my whole point is that when something will eventually happen, right? I don't know what it is. I'm not making any predictions, so don't make any claims that I am, you know, but at some point something will happen. And, you know, there is a consequence to every action, right? For every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. So eventually at some point, something will happen and the culprit will be the stock share buybacks and the share repurchases because they've become too aggressive or whatever the reason is. And then we'll pass a law that bans share repurchases again, right? And then we'll go back to the way it was. But this is what we always do is that we pass laws. Let me give you a good example of this. So in 1929, when the market peaked and, you know, that was the, you know, the beginning of the end heading into the Depression, Charles Ponzi was at the very top of that peak, right? And that was the whole origination of the Ponzi scheme at that point. And so after the crash in 29, in 1932, 1933, 1934, we established the SEC. And we passed the Investment Advisors Act, and we did all this other stuff in the 40s. And one of the things that occurred during that process was that we separated out banks and brokerage firms and said, you two cannot play together anymore. Because going up into 1929, the banks were loaning money to their customers to buy the shares of the IPOs that the banks were issuing. And so it was a closed loop. And so the banks just kept loaning out money and then issuing shares that the clients were investing in. And it ran the market up to the moon until it blew up. And it was fine on the way up. Nobody cared because everybody's making money hand over fist, right? But after the fact, we said, hey, that's probably not a good idea. There should be a Chinese wall between these two. And so for the next really 70 years, the world works fantastic. Everything's fine. Banking crises. We don't have any major devastation. Nifty 50 back in the 1973, 74, you had that big bear market. But there was no big financial credit event, et cetera, of any magnitude. And then in the 1990s, the banks go, man, this is not fair. Look at, of course, at that time, the market's just screaming off to the moon during the 1990s, heading into the dot-com bubble. And Wall Street is raking in money hand over fist. They're issuing out IPOs as fast as they can get them to the Wall Street. And retail investors are lapping them up, and it's all about day trading now. And we have the online trading firms, et cetera, through AOL. You can buy stocks, this whole thing.
Trade baby.
We got the E-Trade baby, the whole nine yards. And so the banks got upset because their whole fee structure was checking account fees, right? And they weren't making any money. So they lobbied Congress heavily to get rid of that Chinese wall until Congress says, sure, you give me enough money, I'll get rid of that wall for you. And we did. And then 7 years later, the market crashes. It's a financial crisis. And who's at the top of that ladder? Bernie Madoff with the Ponzi scheme. So again, we don't ever learn our lesson because we always forget our history and then we repeat things over again. And so this is the problem with never teaching history to people and us forgetting our history, is that we're going to wind up repeating the same thing. So we're doing the same thing. There was a reason we outlawed corporate share buybacks originally. We've forgotten why we did it, but eventually we'll figure that out again and have to pass the law again.
We relearn, yeah. And then we'll probably do something like you were saying with Clinton, where we'll make these illegal, but some little doorway will open somewhere where they can still, the insiders will still get rich, but some other way that would takes us 30 or 50 years to figure out how to close that window.
Well, right? And that's the thing, is that Wall Street is very creative. So when you shut off one door, they're going to open another door. They'll figure it out. But I mean, look, you could stop this problem very easily. And the big issue about share buybacks is really the benefit to corporate insiders, right? And so the one thing that everybody rails against is, how rich these executives are. And it's so unfair. The executives make 50 times what the worker makes. Okay, it's easy fix. You tax buybacks at 35% and it solves your problem. Because at 30 or 35% tax on buybacks, companies will quit doing buybacks. It's not financially feasible for them to do that if you tax those. We're always talking about trying to tax the rich, the ultra rich. Elizabeth Warren out over the weekend, or this week rather, talking about an ultra rich tax. Tax buybacks. It's a massive amount of money. It's $5.5 trillion. Throw a 30% tax on that, you can pay off a big chunk of the deficit.
That's really interesting. Yeah, maybe we don't make it illegal. Maybe we just make it prohibitively costly, right?
Yeah. Or let's help the taxpayers at least tax the damn thing so that, at least we can pay off some of the debt.
Yeah. I mean, technically, that's sort of a tax on the rich, which is if you own the financial assets that are doing buybacks, it's a way to do it that maybe feels a little bit more fair, or at least it's reducing an unfairness in the market right now, right? So anyways, all right, well, look, on the topic of buybacks, what we're talking about here probably will take decades to play out when the next.
Oh, I'll be dead before it happens probably, sadly.
But you actually wrote this piece that you showed us a few charts from, because we're now going into a blackout period for buybacks. Right as we enter, you know, Q2 is looking to be interesting, right? There's a lot of things that are happening in Q2 that may affect this rising tide of net liquidity that we've been talking about a lot. You throw the buyback blackout window, you know, kind of into the mix. So was the point of this article to kind of wave a little flag to folks just to say, hey, be careful here. Some of the rocket fuel that's been driving this rally is getting removed for a period of time.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, what my job is to, you know, look for risk. I mean, that's my job, right? I mean, if you don't care about risk, just go buy an S&P index fund and go home, right? And again, you'll probably be fine over a long enough period of time, right? But what I'm paid for is to watch out for the risk. So, you know, I'm always looking for, okay, what is it that could kind of undermine this rally in the market? And given that buybacks have such a strong correlation to rising markets, that window closed last Friday, and that net liquidity flow is going to be shut off for about a month. So again, it's just one of the buyers of equities has been removed from the market temporarily.
Well, the biggest buyer from your charts.
yeah. A very big buyer has been removed from the markets for about a month until we get into earnings season. But again, you know, right now there's so much money floating around. It may make no difference whatsoever. And there's so much optimism and positivity about the markets. I mean, you know, if you take a look at a lot of the meme stocks, the speculative trades, those type of things, you know, people are just piling into those again. I mean, it's what's so fascinating to me is that this is very reminiscent. The way the market's behaving, this very low volatility advance is very similar to what we saw in 2020 and 2021, where you have this very low volatility, steady advance because of those checks going to households that people were, you know, hopping on their Robinhood app and opening up their account for the first time, yep, throwing $1,400 into the market. But yet we don't have that going on, right? We don't have those checks flowing to households, but it's that very same type of feel that everybody just can't wait to go invest something. I mean, you know, my feeds on TikTok and Twitter and everything else are filled up with, you know, how to trade your way to wealth and, you know, buy these 5 Bitcoins because, you know, they're going to go to the moon next. And, you know, it was exactly the same thing that we saw in 2021 before it all blew up in 2022. The same thing will happen here. It's just a function of time. And I just don't know what causes it. Right.
Yeah. And so that's where I was going with this, which is, I'm sure no surprise to you, but, you know, the people that I interview on this channel, they tend to be, you know, fundamentalists, they're macro analysts for the most part. Although there are people that are TA and momentum based as well. But you know, they're waving at risks all over the place, right? But with the markets now again, and yet another all-time high this week, right? You know, there are folks in the comments, and I get it, that are just saying like, hey, you know, like, you bears just don't get it, right? My question to you is like, I'm seeing more and more people just embrace the like, hey, I learned to stop worrying and just learn to love the bubble.
Right. but you know, that's so fascinating because that was the same conversation we had in 2020 and 2021. And it was exactly the same thing. The market's just going up and, you know, the bears are dead wrong. And then you had 2022, the market declines by 20%. But most of the stocks that people were chasing were down 80 and 90%. You know, if you don't realize this, the average retail investor is still negative. They haven't even got back to even yet.
From 2022.
From 2022. So they're still down about 3-4%. From 2022. And that's because they were invested in a lot of these meme stocks and things that went down 70, 80, 90% in value.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and again, you know, there was this very brief period where we're talking, reading articles in the Wall Street Journal where, you know, people had invested all their money into meme coins or meme stocks and lost it all. And now they're, you know, they were millionaires and now they're dead broke and working part-time at a gas station type thing. And there's a bunch of Wall Street articles about these type of things that happen. And now we're all back. And we all assume that this is just going to continue forever. But this is when you start hearing those comments, that's your contrarian indicator. Because when everybody is exuberant, right? Everybody is bought, everybody's in the markets. That's what sets the correction eventually to come, and whatever causes it, who knows? But remember, we had the same sentiment back in June and July of last year. It was the AI bubble. So remember, in March of last year, we had Silicon Valley Bank went belly up, right? And the Fed steps in with the bank term funding program. and so they come up with the BTFB program and bail out the regional banks. And the market takes off after that point, rallies. The market's up 17, 18% by July. Everybody's assuming that this bull market's going to continue. And whenever the market's up this much in the beginning of the year, it's always up this much more by the end of the year. And, you know, had all this bullish narrative going on. And then the market corrects by 10% going into October. By October, investor sentiment was extremely negative. My comments were all filled up about, man, is this sell-off ever going to stop? I mean, this market's just going to go down forever. And this is how that emotional content swings back and forth. So when you see that type of bullish sentiment, it's normally a great contrarian indicator that something is going to occur. And again, it doesn't have to be a market crash. We don't have to have a 30% decline. But even a 5 or a 10% correction after this rally is going to feel terrible.
Yeah. We're going to have headlines that the world's ending if we're down 6%. Yeah.
Exactly. And so that's, you know, that's what's going to happen. And it's just a function of time until we get there. And it'll happen before the end of this year. We'll have a correction before the election. It's just a function of time until we get, again, 5%, 10%, 7%, somewhere in that range. But you'll have some type of correction before we get to the election, and people will be convinced that this is the beginning of the next bear market. And it's not. It's just a good, healthy correction that'll reset the table so you can put some capital to work.
Okay. So let's talk about this, because so there's, you know, animal spirits running, speculative fervor, whatever term you want to use to describe what's powering all this higher right now. And we haven't even talked yet about Powell and the Fed release this week and how that gave a lot of juice to those animal spirits. But I want to talk about a couple of things that are indicators of the current level of speculation, but also some things that are showing that speculation might be getting played out here. So first, on the like pro speculation side, you were talking that you're seeing things that we've seen in different past cycles. So we've got our first social media IPO in a couple of years, right? With Reddit.
Yep.
Look, I'm not super duper, into the Reddit books. So this is a guy watching from the cheap seats, but I know Reddit as a company, right? And I worked at Yahoo. I know this space fairly well. And, you know, Reddit's kind of been a chronic, you know, case of like, oh my God, this company's got a ton of users, but they don't really have like the world's best business model, right? It's been a laggard from sort of like a revenue generation perspective. But all of a sudden in the AI world, they're like, wow, we got, you know, a couple of decades of user conversations here that companies can use to train their AI on, right? And so all of a sudden there's all this interest in Reddit. And I'm like, all right, well, look, that's kind of like, if that really works, right? That's kind of like a one-time value creation event. Like we crawl your archives and then, okay, we've learned what we're going to learn from that, right? And again, this is all happening in an era where anything with AI on it's going bananas, right? To me, I feel like, just like I feel like the buy now, pay later, like those are the most predictable headlines in the world. I know what the headlines are going to be in a year about that, which is why did anybody think this was a good idea and who could have seen this coming, right?
Yeah.
This one, it seems so easy to predict, you know, that in a year's time or something like that, people are going to be like, whoa, we really got ahead of ourselves on that Reddit valuation. But right now, you know, people are snapping up the IPO. Yeah.
Well, and you probably know more because of your background, you probably more understand more about Reddit than I do. But, you know, my take on it is that you've got a bunch of unpaid moderators, right? So basically, you know, I can be a moderator for Reddit. And I can start a channel. We can talk about, you know, whatever, pink monkeys. And we can get a whole Reddit thread running around these pink monkeys. Well, at some point, you know, the problem I see for Reddit is that, particularly in today's society where there's so much concern about who says what and, you know, is it got an ism attached to it of one form or another, it's kind of the wild west of the internet of stuff that gets posted there. And I've seen some of the Reddit posts, that are out there and some of the Reddit channels, particularly when, if you remember back during the meme rush, we were talking a lot about the Reddit channel, wrote some articles. There was the Wall Street Bets Reddit channel where,
names, all that stuff,
yeah. And, some of the posts that were on that channel were, not for prime time use, right? And so you almost have to wonder at some point, do the moderators start demanding to be paid? Hey, you know what? You're public making money hand over fist. How about sharing the wealth, right? Well, once you start sharing the wealth, that's going to impact your revenue flow because right now you got to pay moderators, pay them benefits, all these type of things. So it seems to me that, the model that they had, it worked great on the private side. I'm not so sure as a public company that they're going to be able to maintain that structure. It seems there, to me, it seems like there's going to be some hurdles to get across that are probably going to greatly reduce that profitability look. And to your point, it's, from the AI, from the AI training platform, I don't know if the value or the information creation there is really that beneficial, because from some of the stuff that you see out there, in terms of misinformation, there's a whole lot of it.
So I completely agree. Yeah. You get, I mean, any system, right? Garbage in, garbage out. There's a lot of garbage on there, right? I'm not saying that there's not stuff, but still, yeah, I think there's some pretty wild assumptions being made at how valuable that is, right? And look,
But to your point though, but here's the point of this though, to this is, look, why do we have IPOs, right? The reason we have IPOs is that Wall Street has people that invested in this and they want out. And when there's a lot of speculative fervor in the market's demanding product. And this is a great example. We saw it during 2020 with SPACs, right? We couldn't get IPOs out fast enough. So we created these special purpose acquisition companies that we could get to market, which was basically give me money now and I'll find something to invest in later. But we do this. But Wall Street's job is to provide product when there's demand, and there's a lot of demand for product. So you take, this is why we get really crappy companies that go public. In 1999, 2000, you'll remember this, Adam, because you were around back then. Pets.com, BlueMonkey.com. There was a whole bunch of these companies that had no revenue model, they had no real structure, they had no business plan, and they went public because they had a website. And by 2002, most of those were out of business. But again, this is where we are in the cycle. There's a lot of demand because of speculative fervor, and Wall Street's going, I'm out. Sell it. Give me my money. I'm out of this. Wall Street will make a bunch of money. Most likely, most investors won't.
Yeah, and like I think Reddit's a great example where, I think a lot of institutional investors have felt trapped in it, or it's big actors have kind of felt trapped in it, right? Because it was like this thing we just can't really figure out how to monetize, right? And now they've got a window where they're like, great, there's a patsy at the table
Exactly.
who wants to play this game. Great, let's let them buy in and let's give them as much of this thing as they want to. Finally, we're out, right? So yeah, I mean that's again, this happens all throughout market history, but this just really seems to be one of those times, again, sign of excessive speculation, where you can just sell complete trash. And I'm not trying to say Reddit's complete trash, but it certainly happens during times like this, where the as you said, the excited late stage investor shows at the table and wants in, and they'll just sell him whatever garbage they can
Right.
unload on him. All
Yeah.
right.
If BuzzFeed and Vice could have hung on long enough, they might have had an exit,
You know what? I think you're right. Right. Okay. So that's a sign of really excessive speculation. Now, kind of on the other end, who knows? Price changes every week, but Bitcoin has actually cooled off here a fair amount, right? Down from like 75,000 or so to now, I think around 62,000, the way that we're talking. Hey,
Not
highly
surprised.
volatile asset, whatnot, but Bitcoin, and I know we're probably gonna get some hate from some of the folks in the comments here, but it is, its correlation with the S&P is quite high, right? And so, when the hot money starts flowing, Bitcoin does well. So could Bitcoin be giving us a little, little canary in the coal mine? It kind of took off a little bit before the markets really started raging. Is it now showing us where the markets might be going? Oh, that if Bitcoin's cooled off by 15%, market might do so too.
Yeah, well, I wrote that article just recently about Bitcoin and gold as speculative warning signs. And there, to your point, there's a high correlation between gold prices and Bitcoin in the markets, particularly as of late over the last several years.
By the
So
way, old people are really taking the other side of that story, but keep going.
I'm sure. Like I said, I got no hunt in that game. So just basically the analysis, right? So take it or leave it, whatever. But the point is that you had this big rush into Bitcoin with the issuance of the ETFs, which was not surprising. And now that kind of initial kind of fervor's over, it's not surprising that you're seeing it cool off here a bit. Now, look, I don't think that Bitcoin's going to crash back to 20,000 again. It certainly could, but not without some type of market-related event. If the market starts to sell off pretty aggressively, then I think you'll see Bitcoin and gold prices down quite a bit more before we get to the bottom of that correction, though.
Okay. All right. So there's that, right? We're seeing Bitcoin cool off. There also is a surprising drumbeat that I got to say, I've kind of been waiting to see, kind of been cheering on. And we've railed about this a little bit in the past, Lance, but we're seeing increasing government targeting of the Magnificent Seven, or a lot of the players of the Magnificent Seven, for antitrust issues, right? So we've seen it in Google, we've seen it with Amazon, we've seen it with Meta, and now we're seeing it with Apple. And I mean, it's kind of crazy when how late to the game they can be on some of this stuff, right? So they're coming and they're basically saying, "Wow, Apple, you've built this really, dominant share of the smartphone market, and boy, you're not letting other people play in your ecosystem. You're trying to create this closed garden," which of course anybody that's been following Apple for the past 20 years is like, duh. I mean, it's exactly that, right? Oh my gosh, Google, you've got a really dominant share of the online advertising market. Duh, right? I mean, how have you not seen that, right?
It's
But
like
it's
you're showing up the party pretty late.
I mean, it's like the fireman showing up at your house when you're standing over its ashes saying, "Hey, your house is getting pretty warm," right? So anyways, I just, I don't think it's going to change anything in the markets, like tomorrow. Although Apple obviously sold off a bit at this latest announcement. But it's all, at the end of the day, it's all about sentiment, market cycles, right? And we've had this just completely bulletproof FANG complex, now Magnificent Seven complex. I don't know. Like, this to me feels like something that if it were to continue to build steam, could really maybe start pulling down, the acting like gravity on these Mag Seven prices.
No, it certainly could, but again, don't forget this is an election year. Also, so this is the I'm going to, if you elect me, the senator, congressman, president, whatever, I'm going to go after these companies that are taking all your money, blah blah blah. You know what? You as the consumer.
And also are like some of my biggest donors.
You know what? You exactly. And this is why nothing's actually ever going to happen because. Once they're back in office, it'll all go away. But I mean, look, the American consumer has all the power in the world. If you want to, take care of Apple, stop buying their products. Apple owns roughly about 25, 26, 27% of the smartphone market. Google owns the rest through Android. So, Samsung, et cetera. So, they don't own a massive share of the smartphone market. But they have a very dominant product. But so you've got other choices, right? Go buy a different phone, stop supporting Apple products. Once they lose all their revenue, then they'll change their behavior, right? You've got the ability to fix these things, but we just don't want to. Always go back to, in 2008, Adam, you'll remember this. We had the Occupy Wall Street movement. You remember that? And we had it was the 99%, right? And they're all going to occupy Wall Street against the evil 1%. And they're all standing out there complaining about Steve Jobs and these massive corporations, and they're all tweeting and working on their Apple computers and tweeting on their Apple iPhones and complaining about the 1% while they're supporting all their product at the same time. So, we have the ability to change these monopolies. We just don't want to because it's not convenient. So we want our congressmen to do it and break them up and do these other things, but really we don't want them to because if you start going really after Apple, Apple's going to lose a big chunk of its market share. And that's going to upset a lot of people in Wall Street and institutions, and a lot of people that own Apple shares and their 401k plans and in their personal accounts and their IRAs. You know, so it all sounds good on the surface. We're going to go after these companies until it starts affecting people in the share prices of these companies. Because this isn't action that's going to make these companies bigger, broader, better. You can go take a look at what happened to AT&T following the breakup there.
So, I just want to underscore what you're saying, which is, you know, a lot of people feel like, what can I do? I don't really have any agency. If I switch from an Apple phone to an Android phone, is that going to change the world? No, right? But then you look at some of these recent consumer boycotts, and to make it clear, folks, I'm not saying I was in favor or against any of these. I'm just noting that they happened. But there were some pretty big consumer boycotts recently, largely on the conservative side, right? So this was sort of a reaction to the wokeism of or perceived wokeism of some of corporate America. So I'm thinking of the Bud Light, right?
Yep.
Bud Light. There was pushback against led pushback against Disney for some of its movie content. There was a big thing against Target, right, for some of their
products.
We'll say, and it really affected their bottom line. I mean, they destroyed the Bud Light. I mean, the Bud Light sales. I think they're still way down, right? So, you know, if enough of the populace decides, hey, we don't support what this company's doing, and we want to, you know, show that in our spending habits, it works, right? You just need to basically have enough of the consumer, you know, publics rally around whatever the cause is, right? So to your point, like we really could do that if we said we didn't like what Apple's doing. You know, we're not motivated enough yet, at least for that target. Although, I mean, worldwide, at least Apple's revenues are pretty flat. So maybe people are starting to vote.
Right. Well, and again, you know, this is just, you know, as consumers, we all have choices that we can make. And, you know, we can look at the bottom line. These companies depend on our spending. And, is you know, if we're willing to sacrifice, or if we're willing to be inconvenienced, you know, one of the best things that we could do, if you really wanted to solve the problems in the United States, is stop buying from companies like Target and Walmart and, you know, other big retailers, Dick's Sporting Goods, Nike, and start buying from your local retailers instead.
Or your local retailers, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And all of a sudden you're going to, you know, if you shift your dollars, and yeah, it's inconvenient because you can't shop online, right? Instead of doing everything online and ordering everything from Amazon, get off your ass and drive down to some local retailers and buy the stuff that you need.
That
they're
going
to pay for it.
Yeah.
They're going to love you for it. It's going to benefit your neighborhood, right? We talk about these disenfranchised neighborhoods. If you want to really help your neighborhood, go shop with your local retailers in your neighborhood, because that revenue goes to them, yes, for their products. They pay their employees, who then spend that money in your neighborhood, and it makes the neighborhood better. But, you know, we're too lazy, because now it's easy just to, you know, DoorDash everything and order everything from Amazon, get two-day delivery, whatever it is. That's convenience. But if we were willing to be inconvenienced a bit, then the economies that we live in would be much better. You know, this is one of the things that people look back and they go, well, you know, in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, you know, GDP growth was running at 6, 7, 8%. And it's because back then everybody shopped their local neighborhood. There weren't these big massive companies to go shop from. So everybody shopped their local neighborhoods and it supported their local neighborhoods. So, you know, we have these choices. We just don't want to because we're lazy.
That is true. That being said, you know, these big companies, as we've talked about, you know, they have lobbied a lot to slant the playing field further to their advantage. Certainly the pandemic, you know, completely accelerated this, where they were the deemed essential operations and all those local businesses got shut down. A lot of them died on the vine, right? And having outsourced a lot of our domestic manufacturing and made it harder for local small businesses to exist, you know, the problem with the local economy is not much is made locally anymore, right? So you've got domestic, you know, you've got local retailers competing with guys like Amazon for the same products, right? And Amazon's got massive economies of scale, right? So you know, it's rough. It's a system where there's now a lot of disadvantages to local guys. And I say this as somebody who was until recently on the board of a buy local nonprofit in my county, which has a, you know, like a competing local currency that, you know, only benefits local retailers and does a lot to basically promote local business. So I'm a huge, huge fan of what you're talking about. So anyways, I agree with you. You know, everybody, you know, be willing to be a little more inconvenienced for the benefit of your local community, and good things will happen.
Right. Well, you know, again, you know, you brought up a great point about outsourcing and all this, is that if we shop more local, it would create more jobs and more manufacturing locally. Now, again, you know, you can't just, you know, flip the switch and say, tomorrow I'm going to do this and it's going to fix everything. It took us a long time to get. It's like, you know, getting overweight didn't happen overnight. Losing weight's not going to happen overnight. But if we made changes to how we operated, we could heal up a lot of the disenfranchisement of the economy and start to even out the scales once again. But again, we're not willing to do that because we have two problems. The first is, well, I'll do it if you do it first, right? Right. That's a big problem. So nothing ever gets done because everybody's waiting for somebody else to take the lead. So, you know, that's the one problem. But the other problem is we just don't really have the time to be inconvenienced because we're so busy doing whatever we're doing. You know, we just don't have the time to do these other things. And, you know, but these are choices that we make. And we're seeing the consequences of those choices that we've been making really ever since 2007 when Facebook became a thing. Ever since then, things have been deteriorating at a much more rapid pace. And the gap between the rich and the poor is getting wider and wider at a much more rapid pace because of these actions that we're taking.
So agreed. Although I'm not, look, I don't have a lot of love for Facebook, and I think that there's a lot of you know, social damage that they've done.
Oh no, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is I'm just saying Facebook was the really kind of that first demarcation of everything being online, the Internet of Things,
sure,
right?
Sure.
That was really kind of that demarcation where Facebook was the leader, then everything on the Internet of Things really kind of came after that. You know, Apple smartphones came out around 2007, 2008. And at that point, we've just been migrating more and more to being online all the time. And I'm not talking about Meta in particular. I'm just saying this whole transition to being online 24/7 every single minute of our day.
I'm right there with you, and look, we could rant on that all day long. Where I'm going with this is this, you were talking about the wealth gap. I think even more here, it's the Federal Reserve and it's our policies, our monetary and fiscal policies that are, I think, at the root of this. Now, there's a lot of things that pile onto it, like what you're talking about. And one of the challenges is as the prospects, and this is why I talk about the plight of the middle class all the time here, the working class, as their prospects get increasingly diminished, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is one factor you didn't mention that's really important is price.
Right.
So as they get more and more pinched, they're like, look, maybe I'd love to buy locally, but I got to buy from Amazon because it's the cheapest price I can get, right? And so we kind of get corralled into this slaughter chute that nobody wants to be in. But when you're just making the decision at any one point in time, it feels like the only decision you can make given your personal situation, right?
Right. No, and it's a fair point. And again, you know, the whole Federal Reserve thing started in 2008. So again, my point, 2007, this all started. But, you know, you're right, is that, and we talked about this before, is that we talk about, you know, inflation, how we export inflation to import deflation. And this whole idea of manufacturing locally, and we're going to re-onshore manufacturing and all these type of things, it sounds great in theory, but we just can't afford it. Because again, when you've got to start embedding all of the cost of, you know, $17.50 an hour in wages or $20 an hour minimum wage or whatever it is that you want, and the cost of benefits and healthcare and everything else that U.S. employees want, the cost of manufacturing locally just becomes too egregious, and I can't sell a product for enough to make up the difference. And that's why we still have to export so much of our labor in order to keep our costs down so we can sell the products we want to sell.
Yeah, and we're trapped in this, which is like we've been talking a lot in this channel recently about you know, eating out. And I've actually done a fair amount of Twitter polls on this right now, and it's pretty clear to me we're at like a tipping point. where people are like, I'm kind of done, right? Like, yeah, maybe it'll be a special occasion once in a blue moon, but like, it just costs way too much to go and get a freaking sandwich these days, right? And I've railed about the $35 BLT in my area, right? But that's an extreme case. But if you're going to go get like a regular sandwich and a drink, you know, you're paying basically almost sort of twice what you were paying like 6 years ago, right? And a lot of people are just saying like, I'm done. I take my family out for dinner, you know, and all of a sudden I'm dropping $150 or whatever, right? Come on.
Of course that, and then everything you do now, everybody's spinning around the computer screen going, hey, I need a tip.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Like, and, give me 22% on top of that crazy amount. Yeah. Yeah. To your point, like, I mean, and what's driving that increase largely, you know, in food is not the input costs of the food, which are going up, but it's the labor costs, right? The labor cost has gone up so much. Right. And so, we get to these points where it really almost becomes prohibitive. So, you know, I know we're kind of maybe talking out of both sides of our mouth where it's like buy local, but like, don't spend too much money on something that doesn't have enough value for the price. Right. But we have to fix one to eventually fix the other.
Right. No, look, there's no solution that's pain free. And this is the problem that we have is that we all want to rail about these different issues, right? We have too big of a deficit. We spend too much money on this. We do this, we do that, this other thing. We all want to complain about these things, but we all want a pain-free solution. And there's not one. You know, if you want to fix the debt, if you want to fix Social Security and Medicare, it's fixable, but it's not pain-free. You're going to have to take a cut in your benefits. You're going to have to retire later. It's just math. We're not producing enough children to support the system. And now we have this big ramp up in retirees that people are just bailing out of the system, which from an actuarial table is a big problem because, you know, all these pensions, whether it's corporates or whether it's the government Social Security program, et cetera, depends upon a certain rate of retirees in order to fund those benefits. Well, if you have a big release of retirees and all of a sudden a big surge, well, that completely messes up all your actuarial tables. And this is the problem we have with, you know, what's going on with this. But again, there's no pain-free solution to any of this. Yes, we can fix a lot of these problems. You know, we can shop local and we can take away power from Amazon and Apple and Google, but it's not pain-free. And, you know, but at some point we have to make some decisions. I mean, if you want to fix problems, you either have to elect people that are willing to fix the problem or you're going to have to start fixing the problems yourself. I mean, that's it. Other than that, you just have to wait for the clock to run out and then everything blows up and then you fix it from there, which is how things have historically always occurred.
Right, right. Which is, you know, obviously the way when it's breaking down, you're always kicking yourself saying, well, why didn't we do it the other way?
Why didn't we fix this before, right?
Yeah. All right. Well, look, there's so many things I still want to talk with you about, but we're over our time and I'm thank you for hanging out here with your voice where it is. Real quick, let me note a couple of things. I want to ask you sort of lightning round and a couple of quick questions. So one, not a question, just a comment. Next time, I hope we can dive into your recent piece about Social Security and the challenges it faces. That's an important piece. You just touched on it right there. There's a lot to dive into. I just want to note as sort of a teaser for people. When Social Security started, I think it was something like there were 45 workers to one retiree, something like that.
42.
42. Yeah. So, okay. And it's now like around 2-1.
Yeah.
Right. So to your point about the system that's just breaking under the weight of the imbalance between productive workers and retirees, that is a staggering stat, right? So we're going to dive into that hopefully more next week. Sure. We didn't talk about the Fed at all. Folks, if you want a deep dive into what was discussed at the latest Fed release in the Jerome Powell press conference, go watch the video that I recorded right after that all came out with Axel Merck. We go into all of it. But I just wanted to give you a chance, Lance, to say anything that material about it that you thought folks should know from your side.
You know, really, it was pretty much as expected. It was a non-event. They did change one line in their statement to employment remains strong. They had been expecting employment to moderate. So employment room has remained strong. So they did change that one line. What I thought was most interesting, and again, you know, the three rate cuts that was already kind of in their projections. The only two things that really kind of were interesting is that the Fed came out and said, yeah, don't pay attention to the dot plot because that's just us talking behind the scenes, right? So he pretty much downplayed the fact that they kind of increased their inflation expectations a bit in the dot plot. Again, what's important to understand about those dot plots and more importantly about the Fed's projections is they're always wrong. They're never right. And they're always too optimistic. So, you know, I track these quarterly notices that they come out with, and I plot them into a graph. But GDP has been declining steadily, and they're always on the wrong side of it. So again, don't pay. And so he's right. Don't pay attention to the dot plot because it's never right anyway. But I did find it interesting that he actually just verbally said, hey, don't pay attention to it. But the other interesting thing was, is that they did push out the projections for further rate cuts. So again, you know, they're now talking about rate cuts going into 2026. Again, when you take a look at that, it says they're going to cut rates to about 3.5%. That too is going to be wrong. They wind up cutting it a whole lot more because if they're cutting to 3.5%, it's likely there's another problem going on in the system that they're trying to bail out.
Okay. The other thing that I thought was notable was he did say, hey, look, we are now actively talking about reducing QT. Yep. Not ending yet, but I think he's looking at that reverse repo almost drained, you know, BTFP now that's shut down. And so they're trying to cushion the bite of feeling the full force of QT when those, you know, liquidity programs are no longer around, right? Okay.
Which I find totally fascinating because financial conditions are now easier than they were when they started hiking rates. So
yeah, it's as if from a financial condition standpoint, nothing they've done has mattered.
Right. And now they're worried about this lack of liquidity when there's obviously liquidity coming out your wazoo at the moment. And again, like I showed you, the money flowing into equities, et cetera, is just running as if we just sent checks to households again. So again, you know, I'd be ramping up QT right now until I started seeing an actual liquidity problem, try to get that balance sheet down some so that I had the ability to operate in the future. But that's just me.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of people that are saying, why the heck are we even talking about,
yeah,
you know, that's right. Now, I will say the chart that you showed, I'm doing this from memory, but my recollection of the equity inflows, you know, we've talked a lot about on this channel with a lot of people recently about how at the end of the day, it's just net liquidity inflows and those passive inflows coming into the market, right? But Michael Green, who tracks that super closely, he's the guy that coined the whole term giant mindless robot for those passive inflows. Yeah, he last time I interviewed him about a month ago, he said, you know, I think I'm just beginning to see initial indication that these flows are ending and may even be starting to go into reverse. In your chart you had, and it's too early to call it a trend, but I believe it ended with them going from 4 to 3. I can't remember what the scale was on the y-axis there.
I believe you're right. Let me, I'm trying to see if I can pull that up here real quick.
See if you can pull that up here. But I just want to highlight this to say, if this is something that continues, then this would be a game changer. Like this would be a real game changer. But
yeah, you are correct. They have fallen from 4% to 3%. I'll show you here.
Okay. And yeah.
So yeah, you can see that little downtick right there. And of course, the last time it downticked was in 2021. Market was still doing okay. They started rallying back up. And then 2022, they peaked off and then went down through the end of 2022. So,
right. And then, so, you know, this 4 to 3 drop might be a wiggle. We don't know yet. But if it's not, then that becomes a really big game changer.
Yeah.
All right. Last question for you, Lance. By the way, I've got a good rant I've been trying to get to the past couple of weeks. We're just going to have to punt it yet again. But we'll get there, folks. Last question for you, Lance, is trades. Did you make any trades over the past week?
None. You know, it's kind of every week it's the same. The market just keeps going up. Our portfolio is kind of tracking the benchmark index right now, which is what it's supposed to do. So there's not been any reason to do anything I want to do something, right? But just that has not been a reason to do things. I mean, I'd love to buy a little bit more Apple on this dip, but there's not been really a reason to allocate any capital. And we're pretty close to fully exposed. So our portfolio is a 60-40 model, basically. And so we're about 57% equity right now. So, and we've got about 10% cash in the portfolio altogether between stocks and bonds. So, you know, we've got cash to spend and our portfolio can go up to 70% equity. But without a correction, there's just no sense in putting that capital to work right now.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll end it there. I'm going to let you have the last word, Lance, real quick before we do. If you continue to enjoy these weekly market recaps, whether you are on vacation like me or in the salt mines like Lance, please show us by hitting the like button, then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. Just a reminder for folks that didn't see our conference last weekend and have yet to buy the replay. If you are interested in doing so, just head over to thoughtfulmoney.com/conference. You can purchase the replay there. And if you want to know what's in it, look at my video. I think it's two videos ago on this channel where I do kind of like a 10-minute, you know, quick summary of what each speaker was talking about. But just to underscore, it was an amazing day. Don't take my word for it. If you watch the video, if you watch the conference, you know, put your feedback here in the comments, and then folks can read to hear what you thought. But from my perspective, total home run of a day. And don't forget, if you are a premium subscriber to our Substack, you will get $50 off of the price of the replays. All right. And speaking of Substack, I mentioned briefly here last week about the new program that we're putting together, where we'll be sharing each week a piece of premium content from one of the experts that comes on this channel. That program continues to build up a big head of steam. I'm very excited for launching that. It's probably going to be out in a week or two, so more details on it coming really soon. But almost every day we get a new expert that's really interested in sharing their premium content with our premium Substack subscribers. All right. And then as we always talk about, if you are just a regular person with a regular life, a regular job, have a family that you got to, you know, understandably give the majority of your focus to, a job that's demanding of a lot of your focus, trying to figure out how to navigate this market, especially when things are as stretched as they are right now, can be a big challenge, sometimes an overwhelming challenge for just the regular investor who watches the show. That's why I keep recommending that folks work under the guidance of a good financial advisor. So make sure that you, if you don't have one and you feel that you would benefit from one, which I think most people viewing this video should, go out there and get one. But make sure that they're one that take into account all of the macro issues that Lance and I talk about in these weekly market recaps and that I talk about on this channel with every guest that comes on here weekly. If you've got a good one who's doing all that for you, great. You really should stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even Lance and his team there at Real Investment Advice, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that you see on the show with me every week. To go do that, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com, fill out the short form there. Only takes you a couple seconds. You'll get personalized feedback from these guys on what they think you should do given your situation. These consultations are totally free. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service they offer to help as many people as possible. Lance, as always, my friend, you get the last word.
Well, have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here next Friday, and hopefully my voice will be a little bit better intact.
Yeah, I know. When I heard that you lost your voice, it was like a universal constant just that could I didn't think could ever not be real.
Yeah, no, I wasn't able to do radio for 3 days this week, so I'm anxious to get back on Monday.
All right, my friend. Well, look, thanks for hanging with us this long. I hope your voice gets better soon. I hope you feel better. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.